And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is Friday, March 1st. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, Trevor May here with you on this Friday. Welcome to March. This is amazing. We're less than 4 weeks away from opening day. It's coming up quick. We've got the series in Korea happening a week ahead of that. So on this episode, we're going to cover a lot of ground again. We have a new StatCast metric that's going to measure misses for individual pitches. It's almost like Trevor wished for it a couple weeks ago. And it happened. So we're going to talk about that, how we might use that information as it becomes publicly available over the course of this season. Spencer Strider working on a curveball. We'll talk about the importance of that pitch for him. We'll talk about the difficulty of preparing for that early start in Korea for the Dodgers and Padres. And our deep dive this week will be into the cutter. So everything you ever want to know about cutters, we're going to try and cover that at some point during the show. Now, Trevor, you had a big weekend last weekend. You were at the A's Fan Fest. And you said of all the fan fests you've ever been to, that may have been the biggest one ever.
Yeah, at least the ones I've been to was with the Twins. Aside from the first one when I was there, and I think it was 2013 when it was still in the Metrodome before they tore it down. In Target Field, you can't see that many people together all in one place, but it was pretty crazy. It was pretty crazy, and it was standing room only, and for like a city block. So if that puts it into perspective for you, it was pretty impressive.
You said they ran out of beer.
They ran out of beer, but right at the right time. Like literally, they got to like right in the end, and then like
and now go home.
Exactly, and it's over. See you later. So I think all the vendors, because they got a bunch of vendors last minute, people aren't familiar with that. They had someone drop out, and then it kind of rallied a bunch of other smaller breweries to join in. So they actually got a bunch of people participating right at the last minute for that too, and it just worked out really well. So the people who put it together were very, very, very excited and happy with how it went.
Yeah, I like those guys. Last Dive Bar,
did a great job.
Kind of an organization that puts out, you know, t-shirts, merch, and tries to keep like fandom separate from team ownership. You know, it's like it's this line they were walking. Like I talked to the field work owner about the situation because Drake Brewing dropped out, and they serve beers in the Coliseum. They have some sort of contract with the Coliseum. So, you know, there was speculation that was never confirmed that, you know, that had something to do with it, that the A's had leveraged it, or that's why they weren't there. But Barry from Fieldwork was pretty funny because he's like, this is the line that A's fans have to walk. He was like, I'm a fan of the A's as an idea and their roots in this community, but I'm not a fan of the A's right now because of ownership. And it was interesting to see that all laid out. That's how difficult it is to be an A's fan right now.
I've seen that a lot too. It was, you know, I was asked that question, like, what would you like to see out of this day? Because, you know, you don't want it to turn into like a rally, you know, where it's just like, you know, cursing the names of the people making the decisions. Cause it's just like not productive, and it's not as, you're not enjoying hanging out with the people that like the same things as you as much. So it definitely was a celebration and stayed a celebration the whole time. And it was just a lot. Like I was actually blown away with how supportive and like nice everyone was being. Cause you know, you get big groups of people together. You know, sometimes the people don't get along very well, but there was none of that. It was like, it was genuinely like the most positive, happy place under the circumstances that I knew there was going to be a little bit. I thought there was gonna be like a little bit of negativity going around, but there wasn't that much. It was just like a lot of people enjoying like sharing off their, you know, their weird A's merch, because man, has the A's had some weird merch over the years. I signed some weird stuff. A lot of firsts. it was a lot of fun though. And it was just really fun seeing everyone's like that, the joy on everyone's face, especially the guys that put it together. They were literally blown away. I just kept getting a kick out of it over and over again, just watching their, like they got a new piece of information, then their face would light up and they get all excited again. So it was a really, really cool thing to be a part of.
Well, now I have to ask, what was the weirdest thing you signed last weekend?
A clock that is half of a bowling pin with an A's clock in the middle. And it was signed by like over the last 15 years by a bunch of A's. I was like, where did you get this? And the guy's like, I have no idea. But it still works and I hang it up when I take it home. So I'm like,
he hangs it up. I mean, his wife loves it.
I don't know. I don't know. I just want to know how the idea happened and then like what the process was to get it made. I don't know when. It looked like something made in like the 80s or something. Had to be.
So someone sawed off the top of a bowling pin?
No. It was like a plastic bowling pin. So it was bigger than a bowling pin.
Oh, but half like, the other direction.
It was in the shape of like, it was like for someone's, like a bowling alley that wanted A's merch, I guess. I don't know. But it's in a man cave now.
I just like how the person who has it doesn't even know where it came from.
He's like,
showed up one day.
It's cool though, isn't it? I'm like, yeah, I bet you I could not find another one. He's like, I bet you couldn't. I bet you this might be the only one.
That reminds me of my weirdest piece of merch, which is this Giants nesting doll.
That's pretty weird.
This is supposedly Buster Posey.
What?
And as Whoa. You open it, yeah, that's Buster Posey. And then this is Brandon Belt.
That looks even less like Brandon Belt than the outside looked like Buster Posey.
And the funniest thing is you open them all up and the smallest one is Brandon Crawford. And
yeah.
Like, oh, maybe this came out like at a time when Crawford was like still the young guy or something.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe the youngin'.
Oh, wow.
Not anymore.
Very strange. And my family found this in Czechoslovakia.
Okay. That might be the bowling pin clock.
But it's pretty strange.
About as random as it gets.
Yeah. At least where you found it, that's bizarre given where you live and where that thing actually came from. But yes, I did miss the backwards hat email if you're watching us live on YouTube. The Live Hive. We need a nickname for people that watch us live. Shout out to everybody who's actually out there watching us live, dropping us comments. I like the Live Hive. Stream Team belongs to the No Dunks guys, so we need something of our own. But Live Hive is the clubhouse leader for us right now. I have a lot of anxiety now about what I wear on the show after on the first episode, I think it was. People thought I was wearing a collar. So you're wearing a collared shirt on the show? I was like, no, cold. Not wearing a jacket. I got
Northern
stripes.
California, always hoodie.
Constant stress now when I think about this live stream and what I'm actually going to wear on it. But let's get to some topics. Let's get to some stuff that's really of broad appeal. The bat tracking leaderboards. These are going to come soon to Baseball Savant. And what they're going to look at with bat tracking technology is the distance by which hitters are missing pitches, which is really interesting because when Trevor was talking about this 2 weeks ago, I thought, oh, that's a few years away. We're not going to see anything like that. So the first question I have is, how do you want to utilize this information? You know, we don't know what exactly will be on the leaderboards just yet. There's a couple pieces they wrote. Both David Adler and Mike Petriello wrote about it within the last week. What would you like to do with this type of information? How would it make you a better analyst? What would it tell you about a pitcher's arsenal?
I want to know what stat Eno is going to make up first. I want to know. Nasty plus or something. That'd be really cool. Yeah, for me, I just think, you kind of break down, like, what is, like, the distance that a ball is being missed by? What does that represent? And I think there's a couple big things. One is that can be, guys deciding to swing is by what they're perceiving. So you can say it moved way more than they thought it was going to move. So they had a beat on it at the beginning and then it just went like 3, 4, 5 inches farther out or in or up or down that they thought it was going to. So then they missed because of that. Or is it they didn't actually have a beat on it at any given time and they just guessed? So like those two things are, I think, both a function of nastiness, but one is like, how much is the pitch moving in a vacuum? So like attaching it to that would be a thing. And then I think like maybe even attaching it to, because I know a lot of people are working on, release point, x-axis, y-axis, like differences in there and like how that creates, deception and things or even like extension. So there's something in there too. I think attaching extension and all those things to also how much is being missed by, where you can say that how deceiving somebody is or not. I just think there's something interesting in those two.
I think this is a deception stat. you know, when you look at the names that Petriello came up with in the piece, you know, the biggest misses are not people you'd expect. The very biggest miss was Sam Hentges. It was 4.7 feet. Trey Turner missed a Sam Hentges breaking ball by 4.7 feet.
I remember that. That's crazy.
It has to do with the fact that basically Trey Turner gave his fastball swing. And then Sam Hentges throws, you know, throws 95, but he also throws a 75 mile an hour curveball. So Turner missed not only in terms of location, but also just timing. That's how it's 4.7 feet. And so, you know, that's what I think is being measured here a little bit is, you know, sort of what happens when you sequencing and deception is sort of what's going on here, I think. Tunneling maybe to some extent. But if Trey Turner is swinging like a fastball on that curveball, he just couldn't tell that was a curveball at any moment.
Right? At no point did he see
it was a curveball.
Okay.
And yeah, that's why I think it's deception. It's about like your release points being similar, your body movements being similar, like the hitter not being able to catch any sort of clue of what's coming. But that makes it a really difficult stat for me because it's not going to be a stat that's about that pitch in a vacuum. Even though it might be presented as such, you know, you have to attach that miss to something. So you attach that miss to that pitch, but it really it's that pitch and the pitch before it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or several pitches before. One thing I think it's going to be a better indicator of trends for guys. I think like big sample sizes will give you an idea of the type of maybe it's a potential or a predictive stat a little bit. And then also if I were a pitcher, I would look at hitters and their like types of pitches and how much their misses are of those pitches that might indicate their ability to see that pitch. Like for a guy like Javi Baez, for example, who swings at well everything, he guesses a lot, and you could learn a lot about which pitch is he missing by the most often. That might signify like a big
you could learn about the hitters almost.
Exactly
where are they guessing the most.
That would be something interesting to know if I were going in to face a guy.
I think it's going to be more valuable the more context you add.
Yeah, 100%.
Like if you start talking about counts and pitch types and what came before it, maybe you'd be able to find stuff that like Stuff Plus is finding about like if you double up fastballs. This is the guy who got the biggest misses on a doubled up fastball.
That's a trend. He very clearly looks for that breaking ball after a fastball. And there's a lot of those guys like getting the patterns like that. Even the best hitters, there's so much value, like finding little things like that where you have like a count and a pitch that you can latch onto and remember. And then when that comes up, you feel like the confidence in throwing that, it skyrockets. And so that's like really the name of the game. Like if more of those you can find as a pitcher, the more often you can leverage that in the proper situations. It spells success a lot. It's really interesting. But again, like you said, there's just a lot that needs to go into it, I think, before you can really, you know, narrow some of that stuff down.
It'll tell us something about the pitcher's deception, and it'll tell us something about the hitter's mindset, which I think those are the two areas that I would be most interested in it. Because then what I would look for is maybe correlating the biggest misses with certain characteristics of releases. Like we've talked about how Bryce Miller has a very over-the-top release for his fastball, and then you can see his sweeper release kind of because since he's such an over-the-top guy, when he releases the sweeper,
it's your birthday today. Yeah. We still can't figure that out, guys. So that's probably going to go for
it. I do the same thing.
Happen that time.
Since his release is out the side, nobody swings at that pitch. So I would assume that he would have like low swings and misses. People would be like, either swing at it because they know what's coming and they want to hit it, or don't swing at it because he can't command that. That thing's going to go flying out the zone anyway, you know? So he tried to use it for freeze takes and stuff, but maybe this stat would tell you, hey, dude, they see this thing, right? Yeah. Like if you have a really small, like swing and miss a number on it versus other pitch types like that, I would feel like that would tell you that they can see it.
Right. Especially if you compare that to like a stuff number, right? If you can look at the characteristics of a pitch that way. And so this is nasty.
Yeah, because Bryce Miller's Stuff Plus on his sweeper is great, but he can't use it.
Yeah, exactly. So then you go, so why can't I use it? And then maybe this gives another layer of context so that you can make it's not very deceptive, or they're seeing it, or it's not tunneling or whatever. That can point you in that direction to make that adjustment. I'm so excited. Hey, all you spreadsheet nerds out there, you're about to have a lot of fun.
Yeah, this should be a good addition to things.
One of my favorite stats from the David Adler story about this was that Blake Snell had 109 of his 234 strikeouts were finished with his curveball. 80% of those were below the zone. And Snell led the league last season of whiffs that were by more than 1.5 feet. They tried to use that as kind of like a big miss cutoff. He had 27 swings and misses that were off by 1.5 feet or more.
In order to set that up, though, he had to throw enough two-strike fastballs, right? So if he throws a two-strike fastball to somebody and then the next batter comes up, he's like, am I going to get the fastball or the curveball?
He's dialed in with it, so what can you do? But kind of guess at that point. But he's got a perfect tunnel with his fastball, too. That's also very helpful.
If we're speaking things into existence here, then I would love more details about the bat's movement through space, because I know that teams have bat path grades for hitters. And I also know that teams don't quite trust them yet. And this is like sort of leading edge stuff. This is like where Stuff Plus was like 5 years ago. It's like people have it. Some people in the organization think it's bunk. And they're like, don't listen to that bat path grade. Other people are like, let's draft on this. This is important. And then every year they try to improve it. You know, they're trying to make it better. So it's sort of, I would say, nascent. And so I would like to play along with that. I would like to also have a bat path grade. You know, my idea was that, like we have with stuff and location, where you pull out how good the stuff is and you pull out how good location is for pitchers, I would like to do the same thing for hitters, where you basically have a path grade. So how good is their bat speed and how good is their loft, basically? How good is their, maybe even their bat variability? Can they have a flat path and a loft path? I would like to give them a grade that's the stuff of the hitter. The stuff of the hitter is his bat path. And then I would like to separate out his plate discipline in much more granular fashion, like we're starting to see some people do anyway, a location plus for hitters. That would be like selectivity plus. So you'd have like a path grade and a selectivity grade. And I think you could do some cool stuff with, like, you know, what ages better, what develops more, you know, what kind of hitters do you want? Like, what can you coach up? Can you get a guy with a great path and coach up his selectivity, you know? Or is it you have to get a guy with selectivity and improve his bat path?
Like, what's natural, what's not natural? That actually starts to get you, start to shed some light on a lot of those things. Then maybe we can finally put the rest of this debate with everyone who loves to just yell about Aaron Judge's how he learned it and mechanic, because everyone's like, that's not how you hit. Well, when you're 6'7", you're Aaron Judge and you're super strong, it is, and it works really well. I think all of these things are valid, and it's contextual based on the person. But once you start to get these ideas of what types of, like you said, how you're grading bat paths, then you start to get nuance, like this type of bat path is, you'd be graded higher because you naturally do it, and you might pick this up same way. It's like a pitch grip or learning a new pitch. Some guys just naturally can pick it up faster because of the way that they already throw the ball. That same thing exists for, I love it because as a pitcher too, I want to know all this stuff as well. If I know a guy's bat path, he can't loft, but he can block off high heaters, I might throw him way more breaking balls. Am I knowing that his natural ability to, even if he sees it, he can't swing correctly in order to hit this to do a lot of damage against me? I might just throw it a bunch of times, even if it's my fourth pitch, because it doesn't really matter. There's a lot of that, inefficiencies like that too, you can learn.
The flip side was that Matt Olson telling me that, like, once I learned about ride from pitchers, like as a concept and what those numbers meant in the scouting report, then I developed a way to hit the high fastball. You know, it's the same thing that I think he got it from Simeon, who was like, you know, you have to hit the top half of the ball. It's like kind of that Alex Bregman thing, but it required some knowledge. He had to like know what it meant when somebody had 20 IVB and what that meant for him in terms of what his approach would be. So, I mean, I think all this stuff is valuable. I can't imagine, obviously that's my bias, but I can't imagine as a player being like, nah, I don't want to know that. Like, I'd just be like, well, then you're behind.
Most of the time, they don't want to do the work to process it. Why? But if it becomes easy, then yeah, they'll do it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's going to be a pretty wide range of players that can make an adjustment like the one you just described with Olsen. Like, that seems very focused, very intense. There are some guys that just figure it out and don't do it with the detailed process. Like, they just realize with an adjustment. They can't even fully articulate it necessarily because people are just different, right? Some people just... they just learn by doing and figure something out. Other people break down the process in great detail, come up with a new plan, build on that plan, and do what Matt Olson did. And everyone was like stunned when the K rate came down and he unlocked this new level, right? Matt Olson turned into a superstar. He was a really good player with power for a long time. But that's really cool that was the adjustment that he made, kind of thinking about it more from what pitchers are trying to do.
Well, then I asked him, why is that strikeout rate creeping back up? Because you had it. That was such a great adjustment. You had like a 16% strikeout rate that year. What happened after that? And he's like, well, I get so good at targeting those heaters with ride that it does open up the bottom of the zone for the pitcher. Because they know now that I can spank that four seamer up, then they're going to be trying to pepper me in low, with that breaking ball. But, he used to be pretty good at that too, So if he has both tricks in his bag, there could be a season. There could be another better season for Matt Olson. He guesses right every time on the slider and puts his loft swing on the sliders.
Yeah.
And guesses right on the four seam every time.
Just a little bit more lucky. Yeah.
He hits like, 300 with 50 homers. Like, he has that ability.
Yeah, he does. 100%.
What he just did last season was absurd. I mean, 54 homers at 283 with a 389 OBP and slugged 604. I mean, just bonkers what he was able to do.
Hard to go get better than that for sure.
Yeah. If there's another level with Matt Olson, holy smokes. Blake Snell, just kind of going back to him for a minute, still a free agent on March 1st. And there's a handful of reasons why I think this is the case. But Trevor, I was going to ask you about this. Do teams generally present offers that are very similar? Are the processes in most front offices for offering up contracts and free agency so similar that if you're millions of dollars apart, it takes forever to actually get to a contract you'd want? Like, is that what's happening with Snell, where the collection of teams that are interested are all just way under what he's actually worth compared to what he and his agent think he's worth?
Yes, that is very common. So here's an example. When I went into free agency in 21, we got asked, like, what's he looking for? And that was the first question by about 18 teams. And we kind of gave him general, like around this range, around this guy, around, and then they kind of came up with a number. And then, 3 year, 10 a year, or whatever, or 8 a year, 324, or whatever it was. And I think it was like 2 for 16, kind of what we were looking for. I'll just say, I'm retired. Suddenly we got 9 teams calling back, 2 for 12, all of them. Now, like, there's not a lot of wiggle room there. Like, that's kind of a logical, right? They're like, okay, you want 2 for 16, 2 for 12. Like, that's let's start to move
and
these things.
Meet in the middle,
see where you guys come back at. And And the way it happened was everyone did that, but you know what team didn't? The Mets. The Mets go 2-for-14.
Like, sure.
And we're like, we're already way ahead. So
yeah.
Gauge this, and they were just ready to go. And that it happened on Thanksgiving. So it just happened that day. Like, just boom, back and forth, about an hour, over. And that's kind of how it happens. When one team separates themselves from a pack, you go. But when you're in the dollar amounts that Blake Snell is asking for and should probably command somewhere fairly close, if three teams are all like, you know, we're going to go, you want six years, you know, 180 or whatever it is, and we want to give you 4 years, 120, and then three teams like 4 years, 120, it's kind of hard to be like, they're not supposed to, but like, they know. Everyone's like, yeah, we're offering them too. Wink. And then it's, you know, they're kind of like, have a general idea, and then they glean some information from the agent. So like, yeah, that is what happens. They don't like it when another team is forcing them into a bidding war. Like, they don't want to do that to each other because they're kind of all in this together to keep costs down. So like, they're not happy with, for example, Steve Cohen, who's over there just like, oh, I'll take him then, changing the market. They don't like that. So everyone's kind of tightening their belt right now, and they're kind of doing it together a little bit. But I think that eventually, Blake, we're going to get to a point where teams are like feeling the pressure to make their team a little bit better. He's just too, it's just too good of a prize, I think, to add to your, he's just too good. So eventually, like, I don't think it's going to be that much longer. I wouldn't be surprised if he might be the next one. The Monty one is the one that's, I don't have any clue what's going on there. I have no idea. It's an enigma.
Enrique Hernandez came out and was basically, he's like more in your bucket where, you know, like, he knows what he wants. 1 year. He's going to only get 1 year, you know, at this point is, and he's not asking for Blake Snell money. And so that's why he came out and said, yeah, I got all the same offers. And he's like, he didn't use the word collusion because it's such a, like a, that's such a loaded word, but he did reference it and said, use a capital C. The thing that I think is interesting is that player valuation to a certain extent has come to a place where it's the same in most teams. And even Enrique talked about that, where he's like, yes, they're all running the same programs. They're all running, you know, you may not like wins above replacement, and there are some difference between, you know, different teams about what they put into their version of wins above replacement, but it's a very similar construct where every team is trying to boil down all the things you do on the field into runs, and then turn that into runs above some sort of baseline, and then turn that into a value. So the structure is similar for almost every team. So my question has always been, is it collusion if the machines did it? They're not necessarily talking to each other, because if they talk to each other and there's some record of it, then they know there's really big ramifications for that. So there's no GM calling another GM and be like, what you offering this guy? I don't think that's happening.
No, that's
just that's what they used to do, and they got busted, and it was a big, big deal. And the players have not trusted, you know, owners and GMs since that day. But how different is it? I mean, I don't know. This is like, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but like, how different is it if the machines do it than if the people are doing it? Like, if they all turn to the machines, well, the machine spit out 1-5. That's what we're offering you. I mean, like, from your perspective, it sounds like, from the player's perspective, it just feels like collusion either way. You know, it's like, okay, you guys all offer the same deal.
I think you're right. And it's just the connotation that comes along with collusion. I think that intent is part of that word. And being on the nose is kind of important. Like, you're telling someone else something because you first know it's going to benefit you, but also long-term it's going to benefit all of you combined. That's collusion when it's conscious, I guess. But then, like, you know, teams are building their teams based on war a lot. Like, it's just kind of a general term, but yeah, everyone does some level of that. You're right. And which sucks for relievers. Let me just point that out.
Yeah. Right.
Because they're like, it doesn't matter who relieves. We're going to win the same number of games. And now that the playoffs, the way they are, that number has gone down. So those are all going to affect the markets as well. But there always has been a level of like setting a baseline. And sometimes the player sets that too. So like, it's logical for them to all start. Like, for example, for me, like, you know, like, what other 2-for-12 just sounds kind of like a bottom range of that. It just kind of does.
And the way that they work also is off comps, right?
Like, exactly.
Arbitration works off comps.
So there are standards that every team's going off of.
Didn't you say in your thing, you said, like this guy?
Yeah, no, yeah, 100%. There's
like, you'll be like that contract. We want like the whatever, the contract that blah, blah, blah got.
Yeah, that's how markets are set. You're compared to other guys, just the same way the arbitration works. So yeah, there's all these like, you kind of, you have to agree on standards a little bit to get your negotiation over. So like if you're agreeing on the same standards with a bunch of different teams, of course they're going to be similar. So like there's that too. Then, you know, some word can be said or something that like alludes at another that everyone else is also doing that. You're like, huh, again? And they're like, oh, everyone must be offering this. And is that collusion? No, because they're not talking to each other. That was on you. Like, so it's a delicate dance. It feels silly at times, but yeah, it's borderline. There's a lot of gray area there. A lot.
Let's make predictions. Where does Snell end up after all this?
I keep saying the Giants. It just makes the most sense to me.
They're desperate. There's two things that make them desperate. Their number five starter just went down with an elbow injury. Their number four starter, his elbow hurts, Keaton Wynn. Tristan Beck is having surgery today at Stanford. And their GM is on a one-year extension.
Yeah, you should probably go get Blake. Yeah.
If it's a problem, it's a problem for the next GM.
They're trying to do the Bellinger. They're like, please, just opt out after every year, you know, like, please.
And that's the kind of deal that the Giants like to sign. They signed Rodon to that. You know, they would rather the Dodgers love that too. So I wonder if the Dodgers are back in, but they spent so much. I mean,
at this point,
like, they got Snell too.
What do you got to, you know, like we're over the luck. We're over
some more money on there.
Just do it. Go up, get in the Cohen range and just wear it. You still got the, you got Japan. Remember, you got Japan. No money.
Just sign the whole country.
You have the whole country behind you now.
Yeah. Everyone, and Yamamoto. Just think about how much they'll love Blake Snell. That's all I'm saying.
It's huge. It's just so strange to see a two-time Cy Young Award winner as a free agent in March and the lack of enthusiasm about adding someone that could be an impact starter when there is such a lack of starting pitching available every offseason. It's so bizarre. I'm with you guys on the Giants, too. Like, that's where I've been the entire winter. They need the impact because they've done the older veteran after 30, lots of injuries, but doesn't have that high ceiling, and it doesn't quite work. They need that ceiling starter. I mean, they got one with Logan Webb. Maybe they developed another with Kyle Harrison, but Webb, Snell, Harrison, that's a lot better.
Yeah, it changes that team so much, and just the back-to-back look of him and Webb, it's like they could not be different, more different, yeah, and exactly. I love that. I think that's really talked about is how big of a, like, those guys back-to-back, same teams playing them both. It's so hard to make the adjustments day-to-day.
I'm a little surprised that he can't. We were just talking about this comp game, right? Like, why can't he just be like, y'all just gave Carlos Rodon $170 million. You can't give me $170 million? Like, how functionally different is Blake Snell from Carlos Rodon? Really big arm, really big upside, lefty, lots of strikeouts, not like, you know, some flaws and some health risks. I mean, it just seems like, just give me the Rodon. Unless he wants more than the Rodon, huh?
I don't see him wanting more than Rodon. I really don't. Because
he would take $180 million, right?
I think he would, yeah. I think he'd be okay. I think he would.
The Giants just make too much sense, though, for Blake Snell. Let's move on. I was looking at the leaderboard in that story I was talking about earlier, the other leaders in whiffs of more than 1.5 feet. Spencer Strider's number two on that list. Eno and I have talked about Strider before, you know, with the fastball slider heavy combo. He gets away with more middle fastballs than anybody because his fastball's so good. It's crazy. Now, he's developing a curveball. He's been using it in a couple of outings this spring. And Trevor, you said something during our meeting earlier this week that kind of made my ears perk up. You think this is a really important pitch for Strider, probably just not even just in the long run, but also in the short run, right? So why is this third pitch so important for him as a guy that has been able to have so much success with two great pitches with that fastball slider combo?
One big reason, this is something that I learned about being a very heavy four-seam fastball guy. I actually just did a little bit of a deep dive on Strider as a breaking down his four-seam as one of the better ones. That'll come out soon, so you'll see that. But like, I think he has 244 strikeouts on fastballs in his career, and 190 of them are swinging and missing. But then now his slider was his best pitch last year when his four-seam fastball the year before, he had a 20 run value on it in 2022. And then it went to a 2 run value the next year. That literal same thing happened to me from 19 to 20, where I went to heavy slider in 20. And that raised my strikeout rate because I had such a reputation for fastballs. So the problem is when you throw four-seam fastballs only, and you don't have a sinker or a cutter or something that gets off of barrels, but is hit more often, you tend to get, it's a high risk, high reward. So lots of swings and misses, but also at higher exit velos, more home runs, easier to lift, you're up in the zone. So when it's one of two options, you're getting hurt by guessing more often than other people are, even though your stuff is great. So there is a point of like deception and keeping guys guessing a little bit in their head, you just, there's only so much you can do in with patterns and with sequencing with two pitches. No matter how good they are, Jake DeGrom only gets hurt by home runs. That's it. So like when he gets hit around, he gives up three home runs. He always says this too. He's like, why does this happen? I'm like, because you throw these two pitches and you throw a fastball up and you throw very hard. So when guys are on you or you're not feeling as good, look at Strider in, at the end of the year in the playoffs, like last couple of years.
Down a tick or something.
He doesn't have, he's down a tick. It's not zipping quite that much. So like what movement pinch do you have? Because technically you tend to, when you lose your fastball zip, your slider gets a little bit not as sharp. They're related. It's arm speed and all this kind of stuff. They're like similar pitches in order to get them to move the way you want them to move. So like having a changeup where you can just like lollipop stuff in, it just moves a bunch. It looks completely different. Everything else is so important in those situations. And I will say this, I went and looked at that. He had like a 17 run value on his slider. He had a 2-run value on his changeup. So it was the same as his fastball. So he had a really, really successful changeup last year. He just didn't throw it very often. So like, it's not that he doesn't have a good one. I just think now he's established it to where he can still throw his changeup, his straight change he throws, or his two-seam change, whatever it is. He can throw that now more and more and more, I think, and he'll have more and more success on it because now he's established that he's successful with the other two. Now it's a time to add that third pitch. I think that's why he's ripe for it.
It's just so interesting, too, the location. So like if you look at where he throws the slider and the changeup, those locations are so much better than the four-seam location. The four-seam location, you're just like, no, not there.
But it's such a good four-seam.
But he gets away with it.
I think the big key is somewhere between that four-seam and slider location map that we're looking at right now is where the curve is going to go. So the curve, I think people will, if they can see it at all, they'll say, oh, slider, don't swing. You know, that's headed for down out of the zone. And I saw him throw. So Alex Fast shared a curveball from Spencer Strider, and it was down and in for a swing and a miss. And that's, we tend to like share, you know, moving images of swing and misses. You know, if we want to be like, oh, look how nasty this pitch is. He got this whiff. I chose to share a 3-2 curveball from Strider that went to the middle of the zone. That was a called strike because I was like, this is how I think he's going to use it the most. He's going to throw this curveball closer to the middle of the zone, and they're going to see slider, like hold off. And especially if there's like two strikes, they're going to think, oh, that's a slider low out of the zone. Like I'm going to hold up, and then it could, you know, pop in. So I think he's going to use it for freeze takes. You know, he's going to use it for takes.
Yeah. Or first pitch.
Yeah, and you got a ground ball with one too. So like he'll use it for takes and ground balls. He's like, when you talk to him, he's like, every pitch needs to have a purpose. And the reason he doesn't like the changeup is that, you know, he thinks whiffs are the best purpose. But after a season in which he gave up so many home runs, I think now he's like, there's another purpose, which is ground balls and called strikes, you know, and that's what this curveball's purpose will be, I think.
Especially with the changeup, this happened to me, and I just see a lot of parallels with him and I, frankly, how we pitch. I mean, he's got better stuff, but like, he's going through the same process, and he's doing it earlier in his career, but he's going to start feeling really good about like changeups that are yanked foul. Like he throws one that kind of runs in a little bit in off plate. Guys went for it because they saw something straight and they thought they could turn on it. That just, and then he's like, ooh, now everything's open. So like, it wasn't a miss, but now I'll get more misses.
But I also got a free strike too, you know, like,
and it's still a strike. So yeah. Not everything needs to be, but again, I am with him with, misses our key, got to get those or I suck. Like, I definitely have thought that before, for sure. Yeah.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
We want to talk about the unique challenges of ramping up for an early start, right? We know the series in Korea between the Dodgers and Padres is 1 week ahead of opening day. My assumption, Trevor, has been it's always been more difficult for a starting pitcher to get ready for the early series when these come around than it is for just about anybody else on the roster. Is that a fair assumption, or are there other challenges for other guys in the roster to be ready a week or so ahead of the regular schedule?
A close second would be probably your day-to-day position players, you know, the middle of your lineup, especially the guys that like hit for power and try to like get that swing back without like something being so you're trying to like have a good nice swing and then letting the power come, so you kind of let that develop. You don't want to just go into spring and just start hitting balls all over the place like really far, because sometimes you will change your swing in the offseason in order to get that. So like guys would try to be really purposeful with their swings and having less than a week. I mean, to be honest, April's usually pitcher heaven anyways, because guys are still kind of getting used to it. The weather changes, it's cold in certain places, whatever. So getting your swing is, I think that's like the thing that comes back the slowest. And for starting pitchers, it's stretching out and it's just having endurance, but it's also like getting in the mindset of competing again, because you're kind of just filling up innings to get kind of passively your body in shape, but then having to flip the switch a bit. These games matter now, and now I can't like just go out and hit my pitch limit. That's tough to do. But the longer, the farther into your program you are, if you're able to throw five innings, it's easier to flip that switch. But if you're at three, you're still in that mode. Like, I'm not even ready to, I can't even get a win. So why would I compete? Not that they're not competing, but like, why would I, you know, and that's because it's like a different, you ease into it. So the older guys too go a little slower. So yeah, it's going to be challenging, I think, for those two groups. Relievers though, I need to throw like seven times. And then I'm like, it's the same thing. It's life or death for me every day. It doesn't matter if it's spring training. Yeah. So let's get out there. We do pride our ability to just like phone rings, roll out of whatever daydream I was in and just go. So I wouldn't worry about too much about them. But yeah, position players right behind starters.
I think I'm expecting that those Seoul games to be very mix and match, that the starters actually don't go that deep and that they use all their relievers, especially since all the relievers have a ton of rest after that. It's just two games in the middle of nowhere, you know, then everybody goes home, you know. So, no, I'm not saying that Korea is the middle of nowhere. I just mean in the middle of nowhere in the schedule.
In the schedule, yeah.
You have all this time afterwards. So I feel the worst for Joe Musgrove. He's kind of in a lot of what you're talking about in terms of he's a veteran. He's used to like, you know, I'm going to just ramp up slowly and then opening day, I'll be fine, you know, and he's coming off of injury. He has a horrible first start, but, you know, he has to just get back out there, like, you know, on a regular schedule, like 5 days later. So he's already had two starts where some people haven't even had one start, you know, and you know, this is coming off a season in which he was injured, but he has to do it in order to even do maybe three or four innings in Korea. And it hasn't gone well for him. I'm not saying that like it's not going to go well for him this season. I still think he's a really good pitcher and he'll be fine. But like, you know, in his mind, there's a little bit of doubt right now because it's been two really bad outings and he's got to get ready in like 2 weeks. Probably not super fun for him right now mentally.
Both him and Darvish, I'm looking at both of those guys. I'm like, all right, it's so important for the Padres that they are themselves all season, given the number of young arms they're going to try
right,
and lean
you don't
on.
Want to push them and get them injured, and you know.
Yeah, so you need them to be healthy and you need them to be effective if you're going to be a team that hangs around and tries to compete for a wild card spot, which seems possible. Everyone's down on the Padres because they're cutting back on spending. They traded away Soto, but making sure Musgrove and Darvish get through the spring healthy is actually really, really important for them. Let's move on to our cutter deep dive. And we're going to start by taking a look at the Stuff Plus model here. You know, this is Emmanuel Clase in the Stuff Plus model with his cutter, as it was one of the game's best pitches.
Yeah, and you'll see with him is he doesn't have the most cut of anybody, but you will see that cut generally helps you. That's where the red is on that side of the graph. That's all good cut This is normalized for hands. So the more cuts you have, the better your cutter is. Also, the more velo you have, the best, the very best ones, that Class A ones, those are 98, 99. That's Camilo Doval. That's Emmanuel Class A. Those are some of the best in the business. But that's, I wanted to show you this graph because that shows you on the bottom is cut, on the top, on the side is speed, and it shows you that generally the two most important things for a cutter are cut and velocity.
Yeah, so the first thing I think of when we think of a cutter is Mariano Rivera, right? That's the example. Like, that's the class. Like, he perfected it, right? So let's watch Mo here for just a second. This is classic, unhittable, dominant pitch. You knew it was coming. No one could do anything about it.
There's his grip.
There's his grip. We'll look at the grip compared to Kenley Jansen's grip here in just a minute. But what's amazing to me, we were talking about this earlier in the week during the meeting, people have tried to replicate that pitch, and they can't. Like, it's been a long time since Mariano Rivera broke into the league and dominated with that pitch. Trevor, what's so difficult about throwing the cutter the way that Mariano Rivera threw the cutter?
We were talking about this. One thing interesting about him that no one's been able to replicate is the amount his cutter rides. He's still above average even in today's game in ride with his cutter. And then you add that to the fact that he has the most cut out of a lot of guys. And that could be a little bit of a different velo, right? Like Class A throws 99, Mariano throws 92. Like, you're going to get more time to move. But the ability to make a ball both cut and ride is unheard of. I think guys have been trying to do it all over the place. Kenley, you know, we're going to see in a moment, Kenley throws the same grip. Robertson throws the same grip. These guys have all learned the Mariano grip. Anyone who throws a cutter throws the same grip that Mariano threw.
That's Mariano with the blue shirt and Kenley over there on the
look how big Kenley's hands are. That thing looks like a golf ball.
And Mo's hands too.
Mo's are huge too, but like, Kenley's got bigger hands than Mo, and that I didn't know there were bigger hands than Mo. Yeah. So that's crazy. Like, just kind of a side anecdote. People say this also about Koufax's curveball. It's because his hands were just massive, and he was able to like straddle the ball almost like fully all the
and
way.
You
around.
Had a detail about the fingers too, the finger length.
Yeah. So, the interesting thing about the fingers, if you notice, the difference in the length of the middle finger and the index finger is usually kind of drastic with guys who can throw these things. Kenley's is pretty crazy. It's almost a full knuckle.
Yeah, look how much smaller his index is compared to that one.
But it kind of moves that index finger out of the way of the middle finger in order to create extra pressure to get that that slight spin axis to get it to spin sideways, just slightly, just so you can catch the air correctly and get it to move in a cut action. So these two guys throw the same pitch, but the reason that Mariano can get that ride is because of where the ball is in his hand when he releases it. And it's all like release height and extension and all these things are into it. But guys who kind of throw underneath the ball, like I threw underneath the ball, Strider throws underneath the ball.
That's how you get ride a lot.
That's how you get ride. That's like a natural indicator of natural ride. But to get a ball to cut while you're underneath the ball, it's so like, it's millimeters in difference in how to get it to cut effectively, because at the end of the day, you're going to get more, the spin's going to get off a little bit, and then it's going to catch the air weird. It's going to go down. So I have a bunch of depth. I really struggle to get anything going sideways. Strider kind of does too a little bit. So like, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a similar thing, but in order to get underneath the ball and get it to cut is so like, it has to be so perfect every time. And I think that's what makes Mariano Rivera so much of a unicorn. He really is. Even those guys with great cutters, they don't throw the cutter that Mariano threw.
So speaking statistically, we did a little bit of a dive where we actually have some pitch tracking numbers in Savant on Mariano Rivera. So right now, this, what we're looking at, the leaderboard, this is the hardest cutter. So those are the cutters that you'll see in that big red blob that we saw. That's Doval, Class A, Ashcraft, Brusdar, Gratterall. They have some similarities in terms of velo, but you'll see a lot of differences in terms of vertical movement and horizontal movement. And Ashcraft is more like a baby slider, if you look at that. That's, you know, if it goes 96 and has 6 inches less vertical movement than Camilo Doval's cutter, I would say that's almost like a baby slider. Whereas those ones with, you'll see 10s and 11s and 13s and vertical movement and IVB there, those are your typical cutters, you know, that have a little bit of depth and a little bit of horizontal movement. And then you see Kenley Jansen has that 18 vertical movement, that 18 IVB. That really sticks out on this chart as he's one of the hardest cutters at 94, but he also has the most ride. And so if you sort this list by ride, what you find is that Kenley Jansen has the most ride with 18 IVB, and David Robertson has the second most with 16 IVB. Well, the math that we did was a little janky, but we tried to come up with like what Mariano's IVB would be. And I think we basically said 19 or 20. So these two guys that you were saying, like they wanted to, you know, throw Mariano's cutter. They learned his grip. They thought their mechanics would be somewhat similar. They got plus ride and they didn't make it all the way to where Mo was. So it's still a unicorn. And sometimes I love stats for that reason. It's like another way to describe how, you know, how unique a pitch is. You know, you can just look at Mariano's cutter and you can look at the results and you know that he threw it like so often, 80% of the time, 90% of the time, and yet still had all the success. So, you know, from a results standpoint, it was great. You know, from what, when you're looking at it, that it was an interesting pitch, but I would say looking at it is not always, it's not always obvious why it was so unique. And then you can say it's probably the cutter that had the most ride in the history of cutters. That's where the evidence is pointing.
And here's Kenley's too, just for a visual comparison. I know we were looking at Mo's before.
Somewhat similar. It looks a little bit like a straight four seam because of the camera angle. But you can see that it has, that's a lot of ride. Like that's kind of a seed of a cutter.
His horizontal is much less than Mo's too, though, right? We looked at Mo's was closer to Duvall. So he was getting like the 19 ride and then like the negative six.
Yes. Five. With Moore's cut too. Yeah, he did both cut. Things really well. Yeah.
So that's what they've been trying to get the ride. They got the ride, but then they couldn't get the cut at that level, even though like 2, 3, 4 inches of cut with that much ride, still very, very effective. Obviously Hall of Fame closer.
Yeah, Robertson and Kenley both have 2 inches horizontal, and I think we said 4 or 5 for Mo. So there's not really anybody, there's nobody that has that vert. Yeah. You have some guys that have 13 verts that have, 4 or 5 inches of sideways. Tyler Wells's cutter has 12 and 4. Martin Perez's is 12 and 3. But, you know, nobody's done it. Camilo Duvall is 13 and 7. So that's a pretty good one.
That's as close as you get, but still 6 inches below the ride. So
yeah, it doesn't have the ride. Yeah.
For 99, though, that also is kind of adding to the value of that pitch for sure.
What's the drawback of throwing a cutter? Are there any downsides? Anything that becomes less effective if you throw a cutter sometimes?
Kind of like a sinker to a... So cutter to a righty from a righty is like a sinker to a lefty from a righty, if that makes sense. So it loses effectiveness unless you can Phil Hughes it and just throw them front door all the time, which is what was his big thing when he had that year and got his extension. So, just front door cutters.
Taj Bradley's cutters to righties got spanked.
Yeah, but again, the margin for error of that is just super small. So like you have to have an elite command to pull that off.
Why do you think that is? He's throwing it low and away like a slider. Is it because people are used to bigger movement from sliders down and away? And when it's a cutter, like, oh, that's actually kind of like just a little low and away fastball.
It's a bad slider to them. But then everyone throws very hard too. So like even the velo loses its effectiveness when it's down and away too. So it's like, if you're down there, you need the movement. The way I always said this to like younger guys, I said, think about the way pitches when you're making the decision. If you're throwing a pitch that breaks really big off the plate and then you try to bring a slider back over the plate, like, and it gets smaller. If it's moving back towards the middle of the zone and the break is less, the chances that gets spanked are very high, especially if it's close proximity to you doing it before. So wasting a slider way off the plate where like nobody even gets near it and they look out there, it's almost better to go do something that's a different look first, cleanse the palate, and then try to go back to it. Don't try to just make that adjustment, get it back over. It's not a bullpen. It's not even about them looking out there. It's literally just about how bat paths work.
It'll look a little bit crappier than the last one or whatever. You know,
you don't want to like lessen movement and then throw it in the same spot because the miss might be closer to the middle of the plate.
You know, we also saw that, you know, we've had Garrett Cole has told me he's very nervous about his four-seam fastball movement and doesn't want to throw too many cutters and lose that. We saw Chris Paddock lose his four-seam ride with the cutter. So there are some people that are, did you even say that you were a little bit worried about your four-seam movement when you started throwing the cutter? I would say that it's a little different. Like Taj Bradley has been throwing the cutter with the four seam through most of his development, so he's comfortable with it. But if you're taking a guy who's thrown a four seam forever and being like, let's add a cutter, that's a little different, because now he's like, well, I'm used to this, and now I'm doing this, and oh god, I've lost both of them. You know what I mean? Whereas, you know, some guys come up with a cutter. Like, I wouldn't tell Taj Bradley to put it away now. Like, use it against lefties. You know, be careful where you use it against righties. It's not going to screw up your four seam because you've been doing this for a while. It's fine. But when you're talking about, if you hear somebody say, I'm adding a cutter, and they have really good riding four seam, I guess I might be a little nervous.
Something to pay attention to.
Yeah, that's right. Doval's movement, I was looking at that. It looked like it's from a lefty, but it's from a righty. So that he it's like a sinker cutter.
Yeah, the question came from Saul on the stream. Is Doval's cutter's arm side movement generally seen as a bad thing?
Maybe it's just a sinker. Maybe it's a two seam. Maybe we just labeled it wrong.
It's so funny because I always thought it was for a long time. But again, their angle also on TV is a little funky and makes it look weirder. But it's so funny. Backup cutters are just called like seam shifted sinkers now.
Yeah.
You're team shifting. You've gone past where it's cutting, and now you're catching the wind the other way, and it's pushing the other way. Technically, when I move my changeup grip, it's spinning like a cutter. It looks like a cutter. It looks
Britton
like
held his sinker in a cutter grip. Zach Britton.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why everyone's like, I don't understand why this works. And he didn't really know either. Because now we know how the physics are working on the seams there. So sometimes, yeah, he does that. Who's the there's a reliever for the Pirates that does this on purpose with a slider.
Dory Moretta.
Moretta, yeah.
His slider has changeup movement.
So people see that spin, and it's just hard to be like, this is going to come into me when everything you've done for the last 25 years of your life has told you that it's going the other way.
It spins like this, we'll go like this.
Yeah. And so guys try to do that too. I don't know if that's what Camille is doing, but he does pronate a little bit. He supinates. He turns in outside his end outside when he throws. But that's why on the other side of the plate, it cuts. So like sometimes it matters slightly where the angle is. If you're trying to throw it away from a righty, it cuts, and you throw it in, it goes and it moves in. That's like an effectively wild type thing going on, but it can be helpful.
The question though is like, is it a bad thing? Like generally, I'm not sure that I would train a pitcher to do this on purpose, but it is one of those things that sometimes, you know, you just fall on this and you're like, well, I'm not going to tell him to stop doing that.
Exactly.
Have you seen what he's doing? Like, you know, hitters can't handle it. So
the common one for that too is to talk about right on right sliders that are up and in. So if you can throw a slider up and into a righty, it never gets hit hard, ever. Like the run value on that is super low, but no one on their right mind would ever try to do that on purpose because it's very hard to do.
And nobody practices it, so they're not very good at it.
And because you don't want to practice it because it's a bad habit, because it makes everything else worse. Like you still
and the mechanics of it are iffy. Like you're trying to change a slider slide up there.
But the data says literally like you're untouched.
That's the flip side. That's like people, the analysts trying to tell you to do something where you're like, come on, have you ever really seen somebody do this? Yes, it shows up good on your chart, but like, you want to see what mine looks like?
I've had a real conversation like that before. Someone trying to do that. I was like, no.
Sorry, dude. I know it's blue, but.
Classic Arsenal toss-up question from Adam here. Moe's cutter or Maddox's two-seamer to lefties?
I'm going to take Moe's cutter because once you swing, you're still screwed. Whereas with Maddox, he's trying to get you to not swing because he's throwing those front doors. So I feel like, you know, I don't have the data on this, but I feel like, you know, once you're swinging, you'd rather be swinging at Maddox's two seam because you've decided, you know, where it's going. You know, it's going into the strike zone. And I think it's probably theoretically easier for a lefty to hit the two seam.
Yeah. And it's also traveling towards the barrel versus so like you
the
hit
the one cutter, right on your hands.
Yeah. You now only have your the handle left. And that happened quite often. That didn't happen anymore, but that happened quite often to most. So like that's not like just imagine not wearing batting gloves. You know, guys are like guys don't like being blown up either. So I guarantee you people would take Maddox's sinker. And also sinkers are hit more often. So like yeah, you'd like to put it in play too. That'd be nice.
I know when you're younger and you're a kid, you watch things and your memory plays some tricks on you, but I feel like Mo was breaking bats every single outing. Like in my memory, like every time he pitched, someone's bat was going to get broken. Like that's just how it was. And I would agree. That's a great way to think about it. There's a much better chance of actually doing something with that Maddox two-seamer if you get a swing off on it. We've got a couple other questions here. Let's see. This looks like a pretty good one here from PJ322. What do you concentrate on when evaluating pitchers returning from TJ? Is it velo? Max Meyer sat 95 in his first two innings post-TJ. Does that pass the test? Meyer looked really good last night against the Yankees. I think that's a really good sign for the Marlins overall. But yeah, what should we be looking for these guys coming off of major injuries who are just getting some of their first competitive innings back?
Yeah, analytically, I would just say like fastball command comes back second. So I think that's something you'd look for. You might not see it right away, but that would be the best case scenario for a guy is he's hitting his velo and he's hitting his spots. But, you know, I'll take velo if, you know, as a good indicator, though.
Especially in the first outing. Yeah, I think the first outing, too, you just want to know that, like, they feel good, but they're also feeling good up here and they're not worried about it. And that's usually a pretty good sign. You can tell when someone's robotic and, like, worried about still thinking about it immediately.
Cole Reagan's that like coming back, his first time coming back, that was the issue. He had been doing so much flat ground that he had like a flat ground, like throwing mechanics, like a pushing, you know, like let's just keep everything nice and nice and easy. He had that going. And then Tread was like, no, you need to throw that thing as hard as you can now.
The competitiveness kind of comes, but if it's there immediately, it's usually a good sign. The only thing you got to worry about with those guys is like, all right, let's, you know, again, we're still easing our way back. And sometimes guys go the other way and they get really overzealous. And that can cause it just like setbacks that are avoidable, like soreness and things. But yeah, if guys are throwing hard right out the gate, then now you don't have to worry about like, did the surgery work? And is he going to be a version of himself? You can be check that box. Now let's worry about pitching and getting the command back and the stuff and looking. Now you can just be a pitcher again. So that's a good sign. Always good to see that.
I'd also be interested in how many breaking balls he threw because, you know, a lot of times teams say you can't throw your breaking ball when you're coming back from TJ or you have to like wait for a while. You do your fastballs for a long time. And so if he was mixing in breaking balls too, then that's a great sign too. That means he's at the point of his rehab where they're not telling him you can't throw a pitch.
Got a question here from Philip. Do teams have their own proprietary statistical languages or do they use things like FIP, WOBA, WAR, all the things we see on Savant and Fangraphs?
I get a kick out of hearing all the different names for Stuff Plus. There are definitely a bunch of different names for Stuff Plus.
Yeah, everyone's got a Stuff Plus. Everybody got it.
It's not really, some of them are called Stuff Plus. A lot of them are different names. Raw, you know.
Acronyms for different things. Like you know, we got Pacoda and Seeger. All the projection systems seem like they're almost all acronyms. Is that what it is for Stuff models too?
Maybe among analysts, they'll talk to each other using those acronyms. But if you're talking analyst to player, I don't think a lot of those have any use. Those aren't player development statistics. They'll talk IVB. They'll talk IVB and velo and spin, you know, and you know, movement numbers. And those are fairly constant from team to team. Like, I think most pitchers now know what IVB is.
Yeah. And everyone uses TrackMan too. And like all the teams, everybody uses the same technology. So it's giving you the same information. But yeah, there's a lot of internal stuff. I ask so many questions. This is my favorite thing to do, asking an analyst. And it's so funny because they always like, you can see they're doing the math. Like, how long are you on contract for? And what can I tell you?
You got to take this away.
Here, but like also not too much to where you're going to take it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Which is, I understand everyone's trying to get their, you know, their edges that way. But yeah, it's usually all those stats you mentioned with all, a bunch of other stuff, all kind of weighted differently. That's usually tried to be built around a team philosophy. Like, this is the type of things we look for. We weight this thing a little bit more than maybe another team does because this is the way we play baseball. And then they try to go from like, that's kind of the process. And then everyone is in different, like along that. Some teams have it really, they're just tinkering with the thing they have, like the teams that are doing it well. And there's some teams that are like, just opened up the textbook and they're starting to be able to build their own ways that things are processed internally.
There's also a question of how much you've invested in your player development and your analytics by a team, because there's a very real question. So StatCast has all this data, right? And it's so much data. Like every 5 minutes of a game is like a terabyte, it might even be like a minute is a terabyte, because it's like pieces of paper flying by and the ump is doing this and, you know, the bat boy is doing this. That's all in there, you know? And so for the teams that have the computing power and the money, they like, give us all of it and we will clean it up and we will come up with our own stats. And then there are teams that just take the pre-chewed stuff that we see and they'll be like, okay, barrel rate. And they will actually use the word barrel rate and they will analyze players using barrel rate. Whereas the team that had all the computing power and put, they don't call it barrel rate. or if they do, it's their own. And it's even spicier and more, you know, got more stuff going into it. So there is a divide there. I'm pretty much 100% sure that, like, you know, a team like the A's is not spending the money on computing power to get the raw Statcast feed and, like, you know, get really deep in there. And then there's like a little halfway point. There's a sort of pre-chewed, but a little bit more information Statcast feed. So there's a little bit different levels. There's two or three different levels you can get in there. But some teams are like, no, just give me the big tube of everything, and we'll chew it up on our own.
And other teams are like, a Fangraphs membership costs $60 a year. <That's> steep. Is that what it's like in Oakland? Can we get that login from someone else?
No comment. Yeah,
right. Can we share one login?
Pay for your Fangraphs membership, people. Support Fangraphs. They're good people. We are going to go. On our way out the door, a reminder, you can also support The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/ratesandbarrels. $2 a month for the first year gets you in the door. It's a great deal. Lots of great coverage, of course, with the opening day being less than a month away. Cover other sports here as well. Got our fantasy baseball draft kit up. You can find us all on Twitter. You can find Trevor at @IamTrevorMay. Find Eno at @EnoSaris. Find me at @DerekVanRiper. The pod itself is at @RatesandBarrels. Join our Discord. We got the link in the show description, and join us live March 20th and March 21st, Other Half Brewing, Domino Park location, two live shows, one on each of those nights. It's going to be kind of around the series in Korea.
Trivia.
Yeah.
All sorts of stuff. It's going to be fun.
Should be really fun live shows. You got a question for a future episode, send those our way through the Discord or ratesandbarrels@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, hit the like button on this video, leave us a nice rating review. Have a great weekend. We are back with you on Monday.
Thanks for listening.